You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Clark Strand. Clark, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thanks, Brainerd. Happy to be here.
Clark, let's talk about what you're working on now. I mean, you have such a fascinating history, but I'd like to jump right in with what's occupying your world at the moment in terms of writing or practice or anything else.
Right. Well, gosh, you know, I finished a book called Waking Up to the Dark, Ancient Wisdom for a Sleepless Age. Several years ago, published that book in 2015, and the sequel to that book, which I have co-authored with my wife, Perdita Fenn, is going to be coming out in November. And so mostly what I'm doing nowadays is what I'm working on are, you know, articles related to that book. It's called The Way of the Rose, The Radical Path of the Divine Feminine Hidden in the Rosary. And it is basically an attempt to reclaim one of the world's, if not the world's, oldest spiritual devotion for a new age of global concerns. You know, most people, I think, identify the rosary as a Catholic or a Christian devotion, but the truth is the ritual that it reenacts is probably as old as human culture and certainly older than civilization, and that's simply the weaving of a crown of roses or flowers in the springtime to celebrate the renewal and the rebirth of the earth. And these flower wreaths, which eventually became the rosary, the prayer beads, the prayer circle, these were offered to the Great Mother every spring. And so Perdita and I started a international, non-denominational, non-religious, really, rosary fellowship called Way of the Rose on Facebook. We have members all over the world. And people holding face-to-face meetings all over the country at this point. And, you know, we basically reclaimed this ancient eco-feminist spiritual devotion and, you know, are using it outside of the Catholic Church and, for that matter, really outside of a religious context of any kind. You know, our motto is basically ecology, not theology. And so, you know, we have all kinds of people. In our group, we have, you know, Zen masters, yogis, you know, Catholics in recovery. We have actual practicing Catholics, surprisingly enough, those who want to hang out with us. We have witches. We have, you know, just about everybody you can imagine. We're very well represented.
So let's jump a little more into this. Now, this is a book, of course, that's coming out, you said, in the fall, The Way of the Rose?
Yeah, it'll be out on November 5th from Spiegel & Grau, which is a division of Random House. And they also published Waking Up to the Dark, which was the previous book I published with them.
So let's talk a little bit more about ecofeminism and especially the wonderful line, ecology, not theology, because I'm interested in how that very diverse group you have online kind of interacts and discusses these issues. Theology, I think I understand what you mean by ecology, not theology, but I'd like you to explain that more because you have a very rich background in spirituality and teachings of a variety of kinds, especially Buddhist teachings. And theology seems kind of, you know, I associate it with a type of philosophy, right?
Right,
so if this is
right.
Ecology, not philosophy, why are they
well, I wouldn't,
mutually
I wouldn't
exclusive?
Necessarily, yeah, I wouldn't necessarily call theology philosophy. You know, it's interesting. I've been on this path for quite a long time. I was the senior editor of Tricycle, the first senior editor of Tricycle, the Buddhist Review, in the 1990s, and I had prior to that been a Zen Buddhist monk and teacher. And I left that because left that world because I felt that at the time, and feel like Buddhism in America, or in Asia for that matter, was really engaging with pressing environmental concerns, which I saw mounting on the horizon. I didn't feel that any of the teachers I talked to had any real grasp of it, and including some of the most famous ones who wrote books about it. You know, when push came to shove and, you know, I interviewed them and talked to them and asked them questions, I found that they hadn't really done the kind of spiritual or intellectual work which would have been required for them to retrofit the Buddhist teachings to deal with an age of ecological concerns. And so by the time I left the monkhood and, you know, the temple behind, and then left Tricycle and started writing books of my own, I was very much on the path of trying to figure out what was the inadequate or even marginally acceptable spiritual response to climate change. What would that look like? And I took a tour through not just, various different sects of Buddhism, but through religions of all kinds. And I found myself, you know, talking to people about long-lost spiritual practices that even the experts I consulted couldn't really even tell me much about. I found old references to, you know, prayer traditions of waking in the middle of the night, for instance, that became the basis for my book, Waking Up to the Dark. And, eventually I kind of went full circle. I guess in the 90s, I was teaching out in Taos with Natalie Goldberg, and I kept running into images of Our Lady of Guadalupe, the indigenous virgin or Madonna of the Americas. And I came back from that trip having been strangely moved by these images I saw of her and the story told of her about her appearance in 1531 in the midst of the largest single genocide and ecocide in human history. And I began to think of her as a figure, I think, who had a lot to teach us. And I taught myself how to pray the rosary. I came back, I told my wife, my Buddhist wife, you know.
And I'm sorry to interrupt you, but that appearance, that was when she appeared to schoolgirls, is that correct?
No. That's in she's often appearing to schoolgirls. She appeared in Rwanda.
That's what I was thinking. Rwanda, yeah.
In Cabejo, yeah, but also you know, to peasants in Portugal and young teenagers in Medjugorje and various other places. But no, this was to Juan Diego, an Aztec Indian, a Nahuatl speaker.
Okay.
Who witnessed the apparition. But in any case, I came back from that trip and, you know, told Perdita I need to start praying the rosary. I started praying it. I was kind of astounded that these simple prayers could put me in a state of mind that previously I'd only been able to get to, you know, after 3 or 4 days of meditation at a mountain monastery. But it seemed almost too easy. I had no intention of becoming Catholic at that point.
And let me ask, what did that mean, praying to the rosary? It was, you're saying Hail Marys?
Hail Marys, the Our Fathers, the traditional 15 mysteries retelling the lives of Jesus and Mary. All the traditional prayers. It's basically there's a prayer for every bead, and if you utter those prayers, the Hail Mary is repeated 10 times in a cycle, and then there's an Our Father, then 10 more times. So by the time you finish a turn through the rosary, you've recited 50 Hail Marys, and if you say a complete rosary, that's 150. So it's basically a mantra practice. And,
and how long does it take to go through a full rosary? I never realized it was so rich in not only recitations, but that's a lot of time, isn't it?
It's a lot of time. You're doing visualizations. It's probably the most complete bead telling practice in the history of the world. In fact, I'll go out on a limb and say it is the most evolved and most complete of all the sort of mantric traditions associated with beads, simply because it includes all the elements that you can only find piecemeal in the other bead praying traditions. I taught myself that, but then I dismissed it after a month or two. I think I thought, wow, this is too easy. This can't be right. you know, this can't be having this effect. I mean, later I discovered studies that they did in Italy where they took, old Catholic late grandmothers in the backs of churches and hooked them up to monitors and devices and found that their bodies were doing the same things, and their brains were doing the same things as Tibetan lamas. And so I don't know why I should have been surprised. You know, we in the West, we tend to denigrate our own ancestral traditions, especially those associated with women, and dismiss them. But in fact, what I later discovered was there was an unbelievably rich, deep reservoir of spiritual wisdom, and it was all hidden in the rosary. The rosary became, you know, like a kind of a stowaway. My daughter, Sophie Strand, who's a poet and a novelist, she once said that the Virgin Mary was basically the stowaway whereby the goddess traveled down through the centuries in the hull of the Catholic Church. And I think her choice of words is pretty carefully chosen, the hull, you know, an empty, vast, cavernous sort of thing. And that, you know, doesn't necessarily in and of itself, have any content, but it contains a great many treasures, some of which it doesn't understand. I don't think the Catholic Church understands the rosary at all, not the modern Catholic Church anyway. It doesn't have any real clear relationship. It doesn't really know its history. It doesn't really know where it began. It has a story it tells itself about the rosary that involves piety and modesty and, you know, all kinds of vaguely anti-feminist sentiments, but which is ironic considering it's a Marian devotion, you know, devotion to the divine feminine. But in any case, I dismissed this, and I traveled through many, many other different traditions looking and seeking. And then in 2011, I came full circle, and I came back to the rosary and to this figure of the Virgin, the Dark Mother. And in that tradition, I found hidden in plain sight, remarkable teachings about nature, cyclical changes, climate change, all kinds of things hidden in that tradition. And as my wife, who'd been saying the rosary for years and years, I mean, I came back and taught her the rosary basically after that trip to Taos in 1998. And, you know, she kept saying it all these years. And, you know, I sort of rejoined her years later in like 2011. I started praying the rosary with her, and we started this group, and it just spread. But the way people relate, you asked about the way people relate online. We are a leaderless group. We bottle ourselves really more after a 12-step group than a spiritual group. We take turns sharing responsibility for like making posts. Like right now, I happen to be doing 9 days of writing on our Facebook group, Way of the Rose. And after that, somebody else will take over for 9 days, and then somebody will take over after that. And so, but in the meantime, people are sharing their stories, they're reporting their answered prayers, they're asking for prayers, they are posting art, various articles come up for discussion about mass extinction and climate change and, you know, various environmental concerns. And, you know, our motto is basically that Our Lady is the Earth. You know, the Virgin Mary is just the sort of latest incarnation of an Earth Mother or an Earth Goddess that goes back for, you know, in human memory for tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of years.
And so, you know, I mean, this is now it's clear the kind of trajectory of all of this, but you're someone who's steeped in the Buddhist tradition. Why do you think this has taken off so much? I mean, you said earlier that when you began praying the rosary, if I'm saying that correctly, that there's much benefit as spending, you know, days at a monastery. But why does that seem to be so of the moment and linked with ecology in the way that you're talking about? Because it seems that this is now what you've thrown all your energy behind as being something that's so much more perhaps modern, you know, to use an odd word, but so much more of the moment and essential. And it does seem to be a type of theology, of course. We're talking about prayers,
right.
You know, in text. It doesn't sound like theology is going out the window with that. It seems that it's perhaps ecology and theology, but it doesn't sound like it.
Well, you know, I think real theology is ecology, and but it became a thing on its own, certainly in Judaism and even more so in Christianity. It becomes progressively more sort of rigid and dogmatic as time goes on. But the Christian story is just a kind of a refitted version of a series of older stories going back thousands of years before Christianity or even Judaism.
Right.
You know, they're basically stories. You know, today we would call them myths, but they're basically stories, typically involving a goddess and her consort, who may be her son or her lover as well, and who undergoes a kind of a ritual death and is resurrected by that goddess. And it follows, the story basically follows the pattern of the seasons, and it follows through patterns of death, birth, and resurrection. And basically the story of Jesus and Mary is just a retelling of that story, in what I guess some historians would call, quote, modern terms, you know, modern meaning, you know, late Neolithic into the Iron and Bronze Age and the age of civilization. So, you know, this kind of wisdom exists in Buddhism, but there weren't very many what I would call feminine folk traditions in Buddhism that cohered, and I certainly can't point to a single one where the old grandmothers, you know, hid their wisdom. You find it in Hinduism. You don't find it much in Buddhism for various reasons. Part of it, I think, is the fact that Buddhism is, as a religion, accommodates to power. It started with male power structure specifically. It started with the Buddha, with his sponsors, and it continued throughout Asia to spread and grow that way. So you do find Buddhist folk movements emerging here and there, and you find a tremendous amount of folk wisdom in the Buddhist tradition, folk medicine, folk legends, you know, and you find a tremendous amount of feminine wisdom hidden in those folk legends and folk traditions, some of it medicinal, herbal, some of it mystical or shamanic. But you don't find too many ways in which it coheres quite like it did in the Rosary. Basically what happened was you had all across Europe and the Middle East, you had a pagan tradition that was based on the mystery traditions of the ancient world. And these were religions that basically, mystery religions that grew up during an age of agriculture when people didn't think of agriculture in the same way as we do today. They thought of it in mythic terms. It was the story of agriculture was a story involving people, and the forces that made things grow were not impersonal or scientific forces. Certainly, they were not objects to be studied or quantified or manipulated. These were people. These were beings. So there was a tremendous amount of animism. You know, the default religion of the Paleolithic was animism, and that lived on well into until about, you know, really as recently as 400 or 500 years ago throughout Europe. I mean, Europe was only very, when the Rosary was beginning to take shape in the 12th century or so, you know, Europe was very thinly paganized. People couldn't read. You know, there was very little way to enforce anything like, you know, theological doctrine or belief. Basically, the only thing people knew, for the most part, throughout the Catholic world during the Middle Ages, was their Our Father, their Hail Mary, and their Apostles' Creed. They knew those prayers. That was the sum total of their theological exposure. Now, they knew a tremendous amount of folklore, some of which was clearly pagan in origin, but which was adapted and retrofitted by the Catholic Church, and sort of fitted out in saints' legends and saints' stories instead. So you get, you know, these figures who sometimes are 2,000 or 3,000 years old and represent ecological forces or patterns or rhythms. or processes, and but they've now been made into saints with stories that sort of embody that ecological wisdom. So people had that wisdom. It was embodied in the stories that they told, some of which were at least, you know, had the veneer of Christian. But for the most part, people weren't really Christian until the modern age, you know, after the printing press. So not in any sort of, not in any sense today that we would call, quote, Christian or religious.
Right. Okay, so that's clear in terms of that. And the ecology, so that makes sense. That separates it as a kind of contemporary theology. But yeah.
Yeah, but these people, and many of whom were women, not certainly not all of them, but the women were tended to be the custodians of certain types of, you know, ancestral knowledge that weren't committed to writing. Even the men who were illiterate, most men were illiterate, sort of put their faith in patriarchy and faith in what could be written and recorded in deeds and yields, you know, things like that. Whereas the women, they sort of knew that numbers and the written word weren't their friends, you know. It's a fairly modern concept that, you know, books are a woman's friends. Books have been used historically until very recently to suppress and oppress women, oftentimes as manuals for killing them. You know, this knowledge and this wisdom is passed down orally, sometimes in fairy tales, sometimes directly, sometimes in spells or incantations that were basically like instruction manuals for how to prepare herbs and how to use them for healing. And these were the women who basically took the ancient mystery traditions of the Greco-Roman world, North African world, and throughout, you know, central pagan Europe. They took this wisdom and they put it into the 15, quote, mysteries of the rosary. Now, this is an odd thing because, you know, the Catholic, if you go to a Catholic priest or a nun or some, you know, sort of a person in an official capacity in the Catholic Church, if they know anything about the rosary, which is not a guarantee, you know, after the reforms of Vatican II, where Marian devotions were sort of unofficially suppressed. But if they know something about the rosary, they will begin by telling you, well, there are these Hail Marys and Our Fathers, and the whole thing is organized with this story, which they will refer to in every language as the mysteries. Now, I've never met a Catholic priest or a bishop or even a Catholic scholar who seems aware of the fact that the rosary is a mystery tradition, and the tradition going back for thousands and thousands of years to ancient Mesopotamia and probably beyond, that is meant to chart the progress of the earth through the seasons and the soul through various incarnations of death, birth, and resurrection and renewal. And basically the message of the rosary is that, you know, endings are temporary, beginnings are arbitrary, endings are temporary. That's kind of the lesson. The time goes in a circle, not a line. And this, you know, they baked this right into the rosary. You know, the rosary tells the story, basically, of the New Testament. It starts with the angel appearing to Mary to tell her that she's with child, and then it goes through the crucifixion and, you know, the resurrection and all that. But it doesn't end where the New Testament ends. The New Testament ends with the Last Judgment, but the Rosary doesn't end with the Last Judgment. It ends with two mysteries, which are called the Assumption of Mary and the Coronation of Mary as Queen of Heaven and Earth. So, and if you look at paintings of the coronation, Mary is not the old woman she should be at the time of her death. She's usually quite young, and sometimes she's even holding an infant child. And so what you have in this story is a circular story rather than a linear one. And, you know, there was this circular ecological wisdom in which all things are included, all things are in going through cycles, everything is reborn, and we're not in charge of it. We participate in it, we're included in it, but we're not in charge of it. And that's the wisdom, the ecological wisdom that is literally part and parcel of the rosary. It's prayers, it's mysteries, it's rhythms, all of it. And all of this got smuggled in right under the nose of you know, some of the most misogynistic priests and popes in history. So they basically took a divine, you know, a devotion to the divine feminine, and they just passed it along without having any idea what it really was.
That's fascinating. So, and the divine feminine relates to ecology in which sense, in terms of addressing it as a kind of, will you tell me?
Well, our earliest images of the divine feminine are these little Paleolithic goddess figurines that appear in the record probably before 40,000 BCE, but quite possibly even older than that. But we begin to find them around, you know, in places all around the world, really. But the ones that are that old are typically in areas of the Fertile Crescent or in Europe, Central Europe. Mm. And they're these small figurines of women. They're all women. They're no men. They're clearly amulets. They are sacred objects. They're meant to be carried and held. They have a devotional purpose. I like to think of them as the first rosary beads because they're tactile and devotional. There were probably prayers or mantras that were associated with them. And just about all of the experts, the you know, paleoanthropologists who study these things, will acknowledge that they have to do with fertility and sex and regeneration, that this seems to be their meaning. Very few of these scholars will go beyond that. Like, they'll notice that you can find traces of red ochre on some of these statues, which seems to indicate that they were covered with red ochre, which most of the paleoanthropologists I've talked to seem to connect with menstrual blood. So there was this sense that these devotional objects were connected to menstruation, to procreativity, to childbirth. They may have been used as amulets to protect women in childbirth. They may have been used to celebrate. We don't know. But this figure of the Great Mother begins to make herself known in the written record, you know, going back, you know, thousands and thousands of years. And when she appears, she's basically the same figure. She's now has life-size statues and temples in her honor. But the stories, there's no reason to believe that the stories that got written down, you know, 6,000-7,000 years ago, weren't basically the same stories that had existed for a long time. And the essence of those stories is that this is a figure whose body is of one body with the earth. Her body and the body of the earth are the same. So that it is out of her body, her divine, you know, Gaia-like, you know, sort of unitary, ecosystematic body that all of life comes, and which is nurtures all life, and to which all life returns at death. So that figure is very, very old. And, you know, her name changes as she passes down through history and through different cultures, but her function tends to remain pretty much the same. Now, by the time you get to Mary, they figured out a way to have her give birth to God without herself being a goddess, which is a nice little theological backflip that doesn't make much sense. It wouldn't have made any sense whatsoever to people in the ancient world. But, you know, so they very, you know, they manage eventually to sort of get her under the thumb of the patriarchy, but certainly that's not where she started. And medieval people didn't think of her that way. They thought of Mary as being powerful in her own right, able to grant miracles, able to, you know, bring stillborn babies back to life and make the crops grow and so forth and so on.
Fascinating. So, to ask you one more question about this, the group is that when there's a lot of discussions in there and writings, and do the writings tend to be about what we've discussed in this interview and different angles on it? Is it specifically addressing the environment in another way in activist terms? If it's possible to summarize that, what what are the conversations?
Well, my suggestion would be that anybody who's interested should just search for The Way of the Rose on Facebook. It's a Facebook group, very vital group. We have, I think of our membership, I think that two-thirds of our membership or three-quarters of our membership are active on a daily basis, which is for a group on social media, kind of astounding. Our members are really involved. And it's because they feel, I think that many of them, will tell stories when they arrive in the group. People will often tell their stories, and they'll say something like, gosh, all my life I've sort of known that this was sort of, what I wanted or what I believed. I didn't believe it existed anywhere. And then somehow they find us, they read an article that one of our members has written, or they read one of my books or Perdita's books, and they discover us that way. So the discussions are very, very free-ranging. I mean, you basically have people who are praying the rosary for their heart's desire. They are praying for love, or they're praying for healing, or they're praying for things. So this is a prayer group. So there's absolutely no doubt about that. The difference is that the people in our group don't see prayer as this, impersonal sort of transcendent experience. They experience it as being very grounded. They're praying to a lady whose body is the body of the earth, and who they see in daily synchronicities and, experience through dreams and in all kinds of ways. And they'll share experiences, sort of uncanny experiences of that oftentimes in the group. But I think most of our members would say that in the face of so much impersonality, in the face of large-scale events like mass extinction and climate change and things like that, the only real hope is to reclaim your own joy and your own spiritual grounding, your own spiritual understanding in your own home, among your own friends, in your own community, and to build locally from there. That's what our group encourages people to do. We encourage people to start face-to-face groups where they can meet directly with one another and support one another.
Clark, it's fascinating talking about this. There'll be links, of course, in the interview so people can learn more about the group and also about the upcoming book, The Way of the Rose. Before we go, I want to ask you one more question, which I always ask, which is, what are you reading at the moment?
I am rereading a book that called The Rose Garden Game, by a woman named Ethne Wilkins, who was one of the principal translators of Kafka. And she wrote this book in the early 1960s or the mid-1960s. And she was, I think, really the world's foremost expert on the rosary. She herself wasn't a Catholic. And she writes from a kind of a historical and Jungian point of view. And it's really just it's out of print now, but it's an amazing treasure trove of myth and legend and wisdom. It's called The Rose Garden Game, A Tradition of Beads and Flowers by Ethne Wilkins. She's also a very fine poet. She's dead now.
Clark, thank you so much for talking to me today. It's really been a pleasure.
It's been a great, great pleasure talking to you as well. Thank you so much.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.